Please be seated. All right, we are back in session, and we are very pleased to have Judge Mark Pittman join us on my left. We are ready to proceed with the second case on our oral submission docket today. Understand counsel have announced the time they would like to argue, and you all are familiar with how the timing will work today and the two-minute warning you'll be given. Okay, with that, I'll have the clerk call our second case.
The court will now call Red Flex Traffic Systems, and may it please the court, Mr. Kenneth Payson to argue for the appellants for 10 minutes, and Mr. Matt Beatty to argue for the appellants for 5 minutes, and Mr. Russell Bowman at council table, and Mr. Scott Stewart to argue for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Ken Payson. With me is my co-counsel, Matt Beatty, on behalf of defendant appellant Red Flex Traffic Systems, Inc. As the clerk indicated, we plan to divide our time. I will address the first part of the TCPA's two-part inquiry as to whether the TCPA applies, as well as Mr. Watson's threshold procedural objections to reaching that question. And then Mr. Beatty plans to discuss why, under the second part of the TCPA's two-prong test, Mr. Watson fails to make his prima facie case with respect to his misrepresentation and Deceptive Trade Practices Act claim. But before turning to my argument, I thought it might be helpful to orient the court, and particularly with this audience, with a brief summary of the facts that bring us here. There's no dispute that Mr. Watson's car was caught running a red light in the city of Southlake on Halloween 2014. Red Flex, pursuant to its contract with the city of Southlake and pursuant to the Texas Transportation Code enacted by the Texas Legislature, provided photographic evidence of that violation to the Southlake Police Department. The police department reviewed that, determined that a traffic violation had been committed, and directed Red Flex to issue a notice of violation. Now, rather than simply appealing that on the basis that Mr. Watson was not the driver, he's complained mightily about that, he paid the fine, and then sued Red Flex, the city of Southlake, Texas, as well as apparently every other municipality in the state that has a red light traffic program and their red light camera vendors. Now, his theory is that the statutory scheme that authorizes red light traffic enforcement is unconstitutional, and if he eventually prevails in that, that somehow goes back in time and unwinds and makes a lie Red Flex's notice of violation that was sent out to him. And it's against that backdrop that Red Flex invokes the TCPA, which was enacted to help those like Red Flex who face meritless claims in conjunction with their petitioning. Protected petitioning activity. So turning first to Mr. Watson's threshold arguments, they're all barred because the city of Waco res judicata argument, his arguments about waiver and estoppel, are all claims that Red Flex won below. In a big section in his opposition brief to Red Flex's anti-slap motion entitled, Red Flex's motion is untimely and must be denied, he raised those very same arguments. And that Judge McCoy below entered an express finding that Red Flex's motion was timely filed and to the extent necessary good cause existed to extend the time for filing. So Red Flex's position is, Your Honor, we won on those issues. And so the claim that we failed to preserve those issues on issues that we won simply makes no sense. And in fact,
so you're saying we can infer from her order that says it was timely filed that all the arguments about that the issue's precluded or that there's estoppel or all their arguments based on that case were decided in your favor?
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't think you need to simply infer that. Turning to Mr. Watson's briefing, those are all under a big, bold, all-caps heading that Red Flex's motion is untimely and must be denied. So that was in the context of challenging whether the court should even entertain the motion at all. Now, if the court was inclined to accept any of those, it would make no sense to conclude and enter express findings that the motion was timely filed, because if it was procedurally barred or any of these the estoppel arguments that Mr. Watson advanced, there'd be no reason to permit the filing or to conclude that our motion was timely filed in the state court. At the very least, Your Honor, though, if there's any question about that, we think that the rather than indulging Mr. Watson in his procedural game of got you, at least there's a question about that, and the court should reach the merits rather than concluding that Redflex somehow waived those arguments by not affirmatively raising them in its opening brief.
And even if we were to address those arguments, it's your position that what happened in the federal court has no bearing upon your opportunity to file your motion in the state court?
Yes, Your Honor. And so on the merits, if we can turn to that, the City of Waco decisions, Stakel, and the other authority on which Mr. Watson relies are all in very different circumstances, where federal district courts, who unquestionably had jurisdiction, first reached the merits of some issues and then remanded. Now, Mr. Watson points out, well, temporally that's what happened here. But what he ignores, and it's crucial that Your Honor takes a look at the Watson v. City of Allen decision by the Fifth Circuit, that's 821 Fed 3rd 634. The court held that the federal district court abused its discretion in exercising supplemental jurisdiction and abused its discretion in not remanding the case. And if you'll refer to the timeline I put up, Your Honor, so I think that's helpful to understand what's going on here. On July 6, 2015, Redflex filed its anti-SLAPP motion before the federal court. Now, by that time, plaintiff's motion for remand had been pending, as well as the various defendants' motions to dismiss. On July 29, 2015, the federal district judge denied the order to remand and granted the motions to dismiss, dismissing the other some of our other defendants. It wasn't until months later, September 23rd, 2015, that Redflex's anti-SLAPP motion was denied by operation of law because Judge McBride, the federal district judge, didn't rule on it. Now, it's also important to keep in mind that there were two appeals going on. Mr. Watson appealed the denial of his motion to remand and the granting of the motions to dismiss. That was one appeal in the Fifth Circuit. Redflex separately appealed the denial by operation law of the law of its anti-SLAPP motion. And the federal the Fifth Circuit then, after initially setting oral argument on Redflex's appeal, issued a ruling order that was placing Redflex's appeal in abeyance pending Mr. Watson's appeal. That was on March 9th, 2016. So there, the court plainly had in mind that Mr. Watson's appeal might have some bearing on Redflex's appeal. Then the Fifth Circuit issued its ruling, concluding that the trial court lacked subject matter jurisdiction, should not have touched the state law claims, and on July 29th, instead of denying the motion to remand, should have sent the whole case back to state court then. So we thought the writing was on the wall, and that the court, consistent with that opinion, would then summarily send our appeal back to the state court. But then the Fifth Circuit set oral argument on the anti-SLAPP appeal. So we were not clear on whether the court intended for us to move forward on that issue or whether that was remanded. So Redflex filed with the court a motion to clarify, and the Fifth Circuit clarified it intended to send the entire case back down. So it was in that context where there was never a motion on the merits where the Fifth Circuit said that Judge McBride should have remanded the case back in July 29, 2015. Should never have touched any of the state law claims, that in fact it was an abuse of discretion to do so, then necessarily if Judge McBride had entered a ruling denying Redflex's motion to dismiss on a Texas anti-SLAPP statute, that also would have been an abuse of discretion. But Mr. Watson argues that the one state law issue before the court that the judge didn't touch, and so by operation of law it was deemed denied, which is a mechanism not to protect Mr. Watson, but to advance Redflex's right to get an expedited appeal, that somehow that state law, quote-unquote, ruling Redflex is stuck with.
So the Fifth Circuit said the whole case should have gone back before it was ever overruled by operation of law, your anti-SLAPP motion.
Yes, that the federal district judge abused its discretion in not sending the case back and granting the motion to remand back in July 29th, 2015, and that timing is critical, Your Honor.
In other words, even if Judge McBride would have made a determination on your motion, it would have been an abuse of discretion for him to do so.
Yes, it's an abuse of discretion for him to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over any state law claims, and there's no dispute the anti-SLAPP claim is under the Texas anti-SLAPP statute, so he could not have touched that either without abusing his discretion. So I realize we're getting short on time. So turning to the the application of the anti-SLAPP statute, I'll just note that Texas authority is uniform in this regard. Reporting suspected unlawful activity to law enforcement comprises protected petitioning activity under Texas's TCPA. Mr. Watson doesn't cite, let alone attempt to distinguish, that uniform authority. So the court doesn't even need to rely on Plumlee to make the same leap that the Plumlee court did. The California standard just has to show that the protected activity issuing the violation pursuant to the statutory scheme was directly linked. Under California law, Redflex had to show it was directly linked. There's a much lower standard under Texas. We just have to show that it was based on, related to, or in response to the protected petitioning activity. And there's no question that Redflex's issuance of a notice of violation is related to its providing to the city of Southlake the reporting that Mr. Watson's car had been caught running a red traffic light. So this court would...
So you don't see a distinction between reporting something to the police and then accepting a fee for sending some type of notice to Mr. Watson?
Well, as it... No, Your Honor, I don't, because the sending of the notice or receipt of the fee is all related to or in response to the petitioning activity. Now, Your Honor, we've allotted 5 minutes of our time for Mr. Beatty. If you have additional questions on the application of the TCPA, I'd be happy to address that. Otherwise, we would ask that Your Honors reject Mr. Watson's threshold arguments as to why the court shouldn't even consider the TCPA claim, conclude that the TCPA applies and that the commercial speech exemption doesn't apply. And we've cited to numerous cases on that point. The uniform authority is that the commercial exemption doesn't apply unless the communication was made to a prospective purchaser, which Mr. Watson is not with respect to the red light traffic technology. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, Matt Beatty on behalf of Redflex. As Mr. Payson indicated, it's my intent to address very quickly why it is that Mr. Watson failed to make his prima facie case for the two different categories of causes action that he brought in this case. And Mr. Watson alleges that there were misrepresentations that were made by Redflex. There were three different representations. Number one, he indicates that it was a false statement that $75 was owed whenever the city of Southlake told Redflex to mail the violation. It says you owe $75. Number two, he says that it was a false statement that we left a false impression that, in fact, Redflex was going to notify a collection firm as opposed to a credit bureau, leaving the false impression that it was going to be a ding or a mark on the credit. And then thirdly, there's an argument that we made a false statement that there's not a knowledge requirement. First of all, Judge, none of these statements are false, and there's not any evidence to indicate to the contrary. If the court was to accept that Redflex's sending a notice that said $75 would owed, that was sent pursuant to legislation that was passed by the Texas legislature, signed by the governor, an ordinance that was entered by the statute, what the court would effectively be doing is requiring any entity that wanted to enter into a contract with the government to be a legal clairvoyant and a constitutional scholar and be able to determine that, well, no, that might be unconstitutional down the road, and therefore any action or statement we make pursuant to those statutes and ordinances would be unconstitutional.
Well, I don't see how you can, on the one hand, claim that you're exercising your right to petition, on the other hand, claim that you're acting pursuant to a contract with the government.
Well, I'm not sure I follow your question.
My question is, you're saying that you're under the anti-SLAPP because you're exercising your right to petition.
Correct.
Then you're saying that the misrepresentations are not misrepresentations and cannot be actionable because you're acting pursuant to a contract with the government.
The question is whether or not they are truthful or not. And so we believe that the analysis is separate. And the way the anti-SLAPP statute sets up is it doesn't say that, hey, look, a statement can't be truthful in the event that you're claiming that you're acting under your constitutional rights. I mean, Redflex has the constitutional right to engage in this activity, as Mr. Payson indicated. And likewise, the state law claims regarding whether or not it's false, something doesn't become false simply because you're engaging in constitutional activity. The statement of falsity is going to be measured on its own merits.
I'm not talking about truth or falsity. What my concern is that I'm not seeing how the anti-SLAPP statute applies to a contract between you and the government.
Understood. The Constitution of the United States does not distinguish between statements and activities that are made for commercial purposes, or whether or not they're where profit is a potential motive, or whether or not you're engaging in an activity for your own individual exercise of your rights to petition government. That's a constitutional matter, and as I can understand that there is in fact a factual distinction, but we don't believe that there's a constitutional distinction, Your Honor. And since the Constitution protects both activities in when you are engaged in a commercial enterprise, and also because it protects activities when you're engaged for your own personal benefit, the anti-SLAPP should apply in this case, notwithstanding the recognized difference. I guess I'd argue, Your Honor, very respectfully, that it is a distinction, but in this particular case, under the Constitution, there's not a difference. Your Honors, of course, I hadn't had an opportunity to cover the issue regarding the consumer status. It's our position that there's not a consumer status. If I could be afforded 30 seconds to wrap that up, I'd be glad to do so.
Yeah.
Okay. The other claim that's made here is that Mr. Watson is making a claim under the Deceptive Trade Practice Act. And of course, under the Deceptive Trade Practice Act, you have to be a consumer. Mr. Watson was not acquiring goods or services when he ran a red light in the city of South Lake and got a ticket. Originally, what Mr. Watson tried to claim was that there's a section 17.50H of the Texas Civil Practice, of the Business and Commerce Code somehow exempted them because they're making a claim under a tie-in statute. It appears from their brief that argument has been abandoned. There's absolutely no way under any case that has ever been decided that Mr. Watson, when running a red light, was a consumer when he got that ticket. They make an argument that, well, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Stewart, and I, along with Mr. Bowman, represent Mr. Watson and hopefully a whole bunch of other people in this lawsuit we filed. As they pointed out to you, this case was initiated actually in the 153rd Court in Tarrant County by us filing a lawsuit against the City of South Lake, who issued Mr. Watson's ticket, Redflex, who administered the South Lake system, the State of Texas, who implemented the red light. Actually, they didn't. They authorized the red light camera enforcement system as it is currently structured in Texas, from which municipalities then enact ordinances that they have to comply with. And then we also sued every other municipality that had enacted and was enforcing red light tickets. We haven't reached that threshold issue completely yet, part of that because of this motion. And how we got here is really important, and I think I know y'all have all read everything that's been filed. It is our contention, and I am confident that this motion and this appeal are both frivolous, because how we got here has already been determined by the federal court. And how we got here was, after filing the case in state court, Redflex removed it to federal court, their chosen form. Then we filed a motion to remand, and if we need to get to that point, how that came about, but anyway, a motion to remand was filed. They filed their anti-SLAPP motion, which, as we all know, stops our discovery process. So then the federal court started dismissing a bunch of defendants, which we objected to, and that eventually led to an appeal for the overrule, and they overruled then our motion to remand, and we appealed that under the federal rules. In the meantime, the court retains jurisdiction. It did not remand. And their slap motion continued. And what's important to note, they filed their slap motion on the 60th day after they had been served with the lawsuit as required under the statute. So they timely filed their slap motion in federal court, their chosen forum. The court did not rule or issue a written ruling within 60 days, which under the statute does result in a denial by operation of law, not a dismissal for lack of jurisdiction, not a dismissal for want of prosecution, a denial. But what's more important to understand, they also then filed a motion to the court bringing forth that issue that the court still had time to rule, and they wanted the court to give them a hearing, and the court had the authority to do that. But the court denied that motion as well. So their argument that all this is based on, that their motion was not ruled on the merits, is just wrong. It's a denial. And what's clear is Judge McBride knew it was denied. He overruled the request for a hearing wherein he could have changed his ruling. So it proceeds the same, and it has the same effect as Judge McBride actually issuing a written order that it was denied. In fact, I would point out a trial court that knows the rules doesn't need, if it's going to deny the motion, doesn't need to rule. It's simply taken care of for them by operation of law. Now, at that point, Redflex had two choices. They have a right of interlocutory appeal, or they can choose not to exercise that right and appeal it at the conclusion of the case. At the point in time that it's overruled and the judge overruled their motion to have a hearing and let the denial by operation of law stand, this case was still in Judge McBride's court. There had been no ruling on the motion to remand, on the remand appeal. Those two cases then proceeded once Redflex elected to file their appeal with the Fifth Circuit Court in New Orleans. They appropriately and timely filed that appeal, electing to impose the jurisdiction of that court with regard to their anti-slap motion. Now, what then happened was we did prevail on the appeal at the Fifth Circuit on the motion to remand. In fact, we've cited the opinion of the court of the Fifth Circuit in that, and if you read that, their argument that the case was remanded because the court lacked jurisdiction is wrong. The remand was not based upon a lack of jurisdiction. In fact, it clearly shows the court has jurisdiction. It simply ruled that under the Class Action Fairness Act, that it was an abuse of discretion for the court to continue to exercise jurisdiction. And so the order of remand was finally, the appeal was granted, and the order of remand was entered well after the appeal of the anti-slap case had started.
So in other words, if Judge McBride would have decided the anti-slap motion, it would have been an abuse of discretion and not within the supplemental jurisdiction of the court?
I don't believe so. The court had jurisdiction at that point. It had jurisdiction over the motion because they were required to file it within the 60-day period while the court had jurisdiction. That then, having invoked that, and that jurisdiction having continued, that decision is being decided in the federal court, not the state court, and that decision is being decided because of their election to invoke that jurisdiction. Now, it also then proceeds, and they are correct, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals then dismissed their appeal. What they are incorrect about is that just meant it went back to the state court. As we've cited the court in City of Waco, what they needed to do was petition the Supreme Court to order the Court of Appeals to proceed with the appeal. That's what City of Waco stands for. When you have a disaggregated issue that has been separated at that point from when it's actually remanded to the court, that jurisdiction in the federal court continues, and you must exhaust your appeal, and failure to exhaust that appeal then results in that decision, the denial, being res judicata.
So I'm sorry, I'm confused. The city of Waco, under the theory in that case, would have required that the Fifth Circuit decision, that the red flex seek certiorari review from the U.S. Supreme Court?
Correct. That is exactly what city of Waco holds. And what city of Waco did was, in that case, they had a situation like this. They had a separate order of the trial court, and then the case gets remanded back. They had an appeal pending at the Fifth Circuit challenging that separate decision of the trial court. And interestingly enough, city of Waco is a Fifth Circuit case. The appellant in that case then, rather than just say, okay, it all got remanded back, filed writ to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled no, where that issue has been disaggregated and the federal court has jurisdiction over that issue, then the appellate court has to continue and rule on that motion. And having failed, and in that case, they ordered the appeals court to continue the appeal and hear the appeal. And as you'll see from our brief, subsequent cases have ruled where you don't do that, where it's disaggregated. Then that actually operates to be res judicata. So part of their argument that they then try to raise later is, oh, well, that part's been remanded. We're going to have to start defending the case while the appeal continues. But that does not appreciate the way the procedure works in the state court of Texas. All they would have to do at that point, file a plea and abatement, advising the court that the appeal on the slap motion is pending in the federal court, and at that point, the state court has no authority to proceed under the Texas anti-slap statute. So they voluntarily elected not to pursue the actual remedy of completing their appeal at the Fifth Circuit. They abandoned that. And then they tried to resurrect that claim that was denied in the federal court here. And under City of Waco, that's not proper. So they filed their motion in this case. And we filed a response. And our response, if you have looked in the record, is rather lengthy. But it raises six different defenses to their anti-slap motion. The first defense was that it was not timely filed under Section 27.003. The next three defenses that were raised, and that's a procedural defense. The next three were substantive defenses. We raised the defense of City of Waco, res judicata. We raised the defense that they were estopped to litigate it here because they had invoked the jurisdiction of the federal court with regard to that issue, and it had been finally decided by the federal court. And we invoked doctrine of waiver with regard to their failure to even request a hearing on their motion within the 60-day period set forth in the statute. Now, the court, and then we had substantive also defenses raised to the slap motion itself. Number one, that the causes of action that we were presenting aren't subject to the anti-slap statute. And number two, even if they are, they come within the commercial exception to that. But getting back to where we are in this case, so we raised all six of those defenses. And the court overruled the defense as to 27.003 for timeliness and said, even if it's not timely, I'm going to exercise my discretion and grant them good cause for late filing here. That doesn't deal with res judicata, waiver, and estoppel in any way. Those are not issues under 27.003. And if you look at the court's judgment itself, it specifically shows it only, on a timeliness issue, only grants any relief under 27.003. It does not rule on res judicata, waiver, or estoppel. Now, They're now bringing forward, I'm going to proceed different. So at that point, the court also just denied their motion without stating why. We know they granted them leave, but then she did not rule as to why she did it. She just said, motion's denied, and they've appealed. Now, when they filed their appeal brief, you wouldn't have known we'd ever been to federal court. They totally ignored that entire process. It's not mentioned anywhere in their brief. They don't mention anywhere the issues of res judicata, waiver, or estoppel. That's important because the law of Texas is if the court does not give the specific reason for the denial, it is incumbent and required of the appellant to address every possible ground that it could have granted it on that was raised in the court. And our pleading clearly raised all those other issues. They've addressed the last two. They never addressed waiver, estoppel, or res judicata. And because of their failure to address that, this court, under the Texas rules, is supposed to affirm the trial court's ruling. Now, they also can't do what they tried to do by then trying to address those points once we raise them and their failure to address those points in their reply brief. So the first point and the simple point in this case is we've already been down this road. Their motion's already been denied. They've already exhausted their appeal in the federal court system. They're not entitled to two bites of the apple. They are barred from pursuing this. And because they didn't even address it, it shows the frivolous nature of the motion, of the appeal they filed. And I'm also going to point out to the court this, well, all that was under timeliness. I'm going to make two points. Number one, that's a form over substance argument. Not the law. The law of Texas, and I think basically every jurisdiction in this country, the substance of a pleading controls over its form, controls over its labels. So a clear and easy reading of our response shows all of these were separate issues. And nothing demonstrates that more than the reply brief they filed in the trial court to our response. They filed that on October 5th. The trial court did not rule until October 28th. I never heard anything.
Thank
you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Payson, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to correct this persistent misstatement that Redflex chose the federal forum. And plaintiff is trying to characterize Redflex as forum shopping. The record is clear, and if you'll refer to the timeline, Redflex's co-defendant, ATS, removed this action, filed a notice of removal May 5th, 2015. In fact, that was the day Redflex was served with the action. It was only afterwards that, after the case was firmly lodged in federal court, did Redflex file a supplemental notice to point out that in addition to the class action fairness grounds for removal that ATS flagged, there was additionally federal question jurisdiction under the RICO claim. That, and then Mr. Watson subsequently amended his complaint to drop that federal RICO claim, which was the basis for the Fifth Circuit then deciding there's everything that's left are Texas state law issues, and this is why the court, trial court abuses discretion in exercising supplemental jurisdiction over those claims. Now, so this idea, Redflex has consistently, I mean, it was along for the ride to the federal court. Plaintiff agrees we timely filed. All Redflex has tried to do at every step is to have some court somewhere attend to the merits of its anti-SLAPP petition. And so it did everything it could to have that heard. Now, this notion that the denial by operation of law is something that Redflex is stuck with, it just doesn't pan out. If you look at City of Waco and Steckel and the other cases on which plaintiff relies, those were all cases where there was no challenge to the federal district court's dismissal ruling. So for example, in City of Waco, indeed, it was dismissing out one of the parties that was the basis for then the subsequent remand order. And as I discussed earlier, this case is very different in that the Fifth Circuit, with respect to Mr. Watson's separate appeal, said the Federal District Court abused its discretion in exercising supplemental jurisdiction at all over any of the state law claims. With respect to this idea that we failed to address his City of Waco waiver and estoppel arguments on appeal and are therefore stuck with them, we are only looking at his own pleading, where he's the one who characterized it as timeliness challenges, for one. So we're not doing anything other than pointing out he characterized all of those arguments as a timeliness challenge.
But isn't that form over substance?
Well, Your Honor, it isn't, because it would make no sense for the trial court to conclude that Redflex's motion was timely filed and that good.
Well, that was an issue. Whether it was timely filed under 27.003 was an issue in and of itself.
Right. But, Your Honor, if the trial court accepted that the waiver and estoppel arguments or res judicata arguments, then it makes no sense to therefore say that the motion was timely filed. It couldn't be filed at all because it was precluded from being considered by the court at all. In closing, Your Honor, we ask that you reach the merits of the anti-SLAPP claim and rule on the merits rather than on any procedural gotcha.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your arguments. We appreciate them very much. And also, thank you for agreeing to have your case submitted at Texas A&M University School of Law. We appreciate that. I believe the lawyers for the other case have stayed. Yes, they're over here. We have about 15 to 20 minutes for a question and answer. The lawyers who wish to stay and participate in appropriate questions from the students are welcome to, and if you need to leave, then we certainly